What is up, everybody? Welcome to The Stack. I'm Alex.
I'm Justin.
I'm Pete.
And on The Stack, we talk about a bunch of comics that have come out this week. And we're going to bring a gun to this first one because we're talking about DC KO Night Fight number one from DC Comics, written by Joshua Williamson. Art by Dan Mora. This is a new mini-series that is spinning out of DCKO and showing what happened. And I'm going to put a spoiler warning for all the books that we're talking about this week, as I do every week. But, hey, I want to bring it up for you guys, you listeners.
Yeah.
That's a great point. Why we're talking about that, in case you're like, oh, why does this sound a little different today? Justin has a mustache. It's not your audio or things going on in your life.
Oh, his audio is not getting caught in his beard anymore?
Yeah, it's the stash.
Or are you trying to say I sound a little different on this podcast? Dogs are barking.
Dogs are barking.
You see, I talk like that, and my dog started barking. That's mustache. Crazy.
My dogs are barking. That's mustache. Your feet hurt.
Pete's having such a great time with the mustache because he doesn't want to talk about comic books anymore. Then let's talk about comic books. So Night Fight is a mini-series that spins off of DCKO. Now, the thing that happened, one of the big shockers of the first issue of DCKO is Joker killed Batman. We get a little more illumination about what was going on there, which is that Batman thought that he built a little bit of a failsafe, no pun intended, on the villain failsafe to get out of the competition if he died so he could still help in the outside world, be in the competition. This isn't explicit in the first issue, but they did talk about it on the DCKO panel. This is basically the heart of Apocalypse is like, you don't get to cheat, Batman, and now has thrust him into a situation where he is fighting a series of Robins who have done a better job of being a Batman than him. And in this issue, we get to see how Dick Grayson might handle being Batman in his stead. And it turns out, in fact, very well. What do we think about this first issue, fellas?
Well, I thought this was a blast. I thought this was like really kind of crazy and fun. I mean, my pool is unfortunately shot to shit, but I do think that my bracket.
You're talking about our bracket. Your bracket.
Yeah, my bracket. Yeah.
But also, Pete has a pool in his backyard, and every night he goes out there, takes his revolver, and he shoots it at that pool.
Yeah, man. You can't shoot an above-ground pool. That's over.
Yeah. Sorry, my mustache was talking there for me a little bit. But, yeah, I just think this is so crazy and fun, and they're really kind of leaning into this. So, like, why not a world of Robins and to see what would happen and all that kind of stuff. So, tons of action, amazing art. KO, let's go. I'm having a blast with this, man.
The art is fantastic. There's a page, 16, 17, where there's just a little split line between the two Batman as they're running at each other that was just so smartly done. The Dan Mora art is just really crushing. And then I like the story as well. It's really uncomfortable to see Dick Grayson being nasty to Bruce Wayne. You didn't see Dick Grayson being a dick. Rick Grayson, the very forgettable head-injured Nightwing aside, we don't really think, a story that I think we can all hit ourselves in the head until we forget. You don't really see Dick Grayson being a dick, pun intended, but here it actually works, and his justification why he's a better Batman, because he, like, talks to people, I was like, wow, real therapy-level idea for Batman to consider.
We talked about this a little bit on the live show, but one of the things I was really struck with when Scott Snyder and Joshua Williams were talking about Night Fight and other spinoffs from DCKO on the DCKO panel at New York Comic Con was, and this seems like such a obvious thing, but they really talked about, like, why are we doing events and why are we doing these spinoffs? And you can see that thought come through here because this isn't, there is the idea of, like Pete was saying, hey, it's cool to see Batman fight other Batmen that happen to be the Robins. But there's also the emotional aspect that Justin is talking about that really plays here. Like, what does it do to Batman? What direction does it put him in that he's like, oh, maybe they are doing a better job than me. Maybe I'm not not the greatest hero of all time. Maybe I haven't bought it. You know, I bought into my hype too much. And that's really interesting. I'm always a fan of seeing Batman put on his back legs. I think that's, you don't get to see that a lot.
He has so many legs, and I love when he's on his back ones.
Totally. Also, really
Alfred,
cool
do you think
costume.
I've bought into my own hype too much? Alfred, what do you think about my hype? Have I bought into it too much?
That's him sucking soup, by the way. Between
he's Alex, when you eat soup, is that what you say? You're sucking soup?
Why don't you go suck some soup, bro?
Yeah. Well, what go would suck you soup. Suck, Pete? Pete, if you're not going to suck soup, what would you suck? Would you be...
No. Boo.
You fell sucking on
boo.
A cheese stick.
You force that.
Now we have to pay an actor to say, go suck soup, which is the ultimate Alex Alvin insult.
Anyway, all I was going to say is Dan Moore
sucking
made
on
some
soup.
Let me finish. Dan Moore did some great costumes for Batman. Moving on to Planet She-Hulk number one from Marvel.
Yeah!
Written by Stephanie Phillips, art by Aaron Cooter. This is spinning off of Imperial, the cosmic event, which left She-Hulk on Sakaar while Hulk went off to do some other things. And here she is still trying to grapple with being on the planet, kind of ruling the planet, a bunch of other people wanting to rule the planet. She gets caught in the middle of a quest for power from a bunch of different people. Pete, you seem pretty hyped about this one. Take it away.
So yeah, I love this. It doesn't suck soup. This is a great issue, and you know, it's kind of a fun thing of like, you know, a layer of what would you do for family. You know what I mean? Which is kind of a nice thing that we don't always see with She-Hulk. So it's kind of a fun position.
You mean like if your cousin is like, you have to run this planet?
Hey, if your cousin comes up to you.
Can I ask you an honest question? Sure. You read this book and what you thought is, wow, what if my brother left his kids with me? Right?
Yeah, exactly. I was like, man, how many days could you watch somebody's kids? You know what I mean? Like, hey, take care of this war plant. Take care of this war planet for me. I'm only going to be gone for 5 days. It's like, oh, man. You know, so, yeah, this is a cool premise. I love the setup. Also, what's great is to see She-Hulk reacting differently. You know what I mean? Like, we've seen Hulk run up things. So having She-Hulk be like, five wives? Really, bro? Five fucking wives? You know, like, this is fun. This is a breath of fresh air. This is cool to kind of see this take on this crazy war planet. So, yeah, I'm excited about all this. Tons of action, tons of fight. He's taking on a giant dragon with a giant sword. Yes, please, to all of it.
Five wives? This book is great. I mean, this retroactively makes all of Imperial worth it, I feel like, to land on this book because the art is fantastic. Like, really captures, like, a almost slicker version of the Planet Hulk art style, giving it its own flavor while still being true to the Sakaar look and feel. And it's just so refreshing to see this kind of story of a character who is in a strange place, maintaining her personality and charisma while also just embarking in this whole other thing. It's got a lighter feel than the Planet Hulk stuff. Plus, just one of my favorite reads of the week.
Shout out to Nachos. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Definitely a shout out to Nachos. I really enjoyed this as well. This is not in any way diminishing Stephanie Phillips, but I will read absolutely anything that Aaron Cooter draws. So I'm always hyped to see his art. I will say
Before you move on, Alex, go ahead.
I'm not going to move on. The one thing that like I got a little held up under the book, and I don't think it's bad, but it didn't quite work for me in this issue, was the classic She-Hulk asides. And the reason for that is I think those panels were a little too tight on the page. Like, I didn't have a problem with the content of them. I thought they worked, and it's fun to have her. Oh, let me finish. It's fun to have her in this situation still doing the classic She-Hulk, like, comedy asides, commenting on the action. But the way that they were structured on the page, it didn't pace out comedically for me in the way that I think it was meant to. Go ahead, Pete.
So you were saying it's too tight? The art is too tight? Come on, man. Yeah. It can't be too tight.
Yes, it can. Well, are you trying to do a too-tight bananas joke or something?
Super tight bananas, bro. Great. The art is super tight bananas.
Yes, it's great. Well, the panel structure is too tight.
Pete, you said shout out to Nachos a minute ago, and Nachos just texted me and said, "Get my name out of your mouth."
Wow,
you, Pete. I don't know what you did to. I don't know what you did to Nachos, Pete, but Nachos come for are me, mad Nachos. At you.
Yeah, come for me, Nachos. I got nothing but love for Nachos.
G.I. Joe number 13 from Skybound at Image Comics, written by Joshua Williamson, art by Tom Riley. This is the first of the five-part Dreadnought War that's going to be rolling out bi-weekly. I will mention I chatted with the team behind the book. That's going to be up in the Comic Book Club feed at noon today, or is already up if you're listening to this Stack podcast later on. But in this book, we get to see Duke and Cobra Commander forced to team up on the run, Mad Max style, from the Dreadnoughts. Meanwhile, there's some machinations going on back at Cobra headquarters, specifically with Destro taking charge by the end of the issue, with the promise of more wild twists to come. I got to tell you, like, I think we've generally been enjoying the G.I. Joe series. I know you're over the moon for it, Pete.
Joe.
I thought this was great. Like, this felt like everything that they've been setting up for the first 12 issues, they hit issue 13. They're like, great, we got all the setup out of the way. Let's go.
Yeah. I'm glad you're... Oh, go ahead.
I'll go, and you can save your yelling enthusiasm for 1 minute from now. But this felt like the first issue that was like, we are moving now. There's no more setup. It's just hitting it and hitting it hard. It's just very funny to me that the Dreadnoughts, these fearsome villains, are roll up like the Hair Bear Bunch in a bunch of random goof cars. And they're like, oh, no, the fearful Dreadnoughts. And you're like, these guys are like a bunch of Archies in their jalopies showing up with like homemade bazookas. So I don't know. I guess that's strange to me.
They're more Jughead than Archie, those Dreadnoughts. But they're chaos agents. Bunch of
jugs?
Yeah, but a bunch of chaos agents is what they are. Yeah, I'm glad you guys are finally getting on board. This is a total blast. I haven't – first off – epic panel when Duke is saving Cobra Commander, and Cobra Commander's like, Duke? Like, what are you doing here? Yeah. Oh, my God, just...
Perfect Cobra Commander voice. Really good, Pete.
Thank you. Thank
Duke?
You so much. It was just such a crazy panel. I laughed out loud. I'm having a blast with this. Yeah, you know, we got the classic, hero handcuffed to the villain. Can they get along? Will they be able to survive? Will all that kind of high stakes fun.
Yeah.
And then the battle for the throne. Now that Cobra Commander is like out on a mission, you know, like just classic G.I. Joe fun here. And excited for the Dreadnought War, man.
Really great.
It's a blast.
Justin, you already talked. Why don't we move on and talk about Harley and Ivy, Life and Crimes, number one from DC Comics by Erica Henderson. This is telling the definitive origin story of the love story of Harley Quinn and Poison Ivy, which you'd be forgiven from thinking already happened in comics, but it actually never did. Because of a variety of circumstances, people assumed it for a while, and then they just kind of skipped past it. And they were together, if I remember correctly, Jimmy Palmiotti and Amanda Connor during their Harley Quinn run weren't allowed to have them kiss, and then later on did have them kiss, and then they were kind of just like a couple, and everybody assumed it. And that actually, I believe, only happened after they became a couple in the second season of the Harley Quinn TV show.
Yeah, which
so
is a great
show. So they did
show.
It first, and then they were allowed to do it in comics. Why? Because of a lot of homophobia in the comic book industry and nervousness from Warner Brothers and DC Comics. So that story of how they got together, other than like us filling in the blanks between Harley broke up with Joker and then got together with Poison Ivy, is finally getting filled out here. And this is great. A great setup, exactly what I wanted out of this. Erica Henderson, awesome art. Lovely, just like enemies to lovers story here. You have these dueling narration between Harley and Ivy, where it's almost like When Harry Met Sally style, the big like, no, you got the details wrong. That's not what happened. Very fun. We get a terrifying face cut off Joker from that era there.
Oh, my
which
God.
Is
the crazy
choice.
That. Yeah.
Well, that was, I think,
time-wise.
Yeah,
that was Scott Snyder had that. Yeah.
Anyway, I was very excited. This is the book that I was most hyped for this week, and it absolutely delivered. It was cute. It's fun. Great art. Great times.
It's so good. And just, you know, from a storytelling perspective, that transition from dating the Joker to dating Poison Ivy is wild. Like, when we first met Harley Quinn in the Batman the Animated Series episodes, where she is, and that is the character, the same character, like the Mr. J. We get a big Mr. J shout out here.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, that's to this character that now I think is, you know, so much more of a fully formed person. It's just really important to tell this story. So glad it's being told here.
Yeah, I agree. This is great. This is a lot of fun. Yeah, I'm interested in how this is all going to go down. I was also kind of surprised at the what we're doing with this, with the Mr. J stuff. I thought maybe that would be all kind of in the past, but really kind of digging into it. So, yeah, interested to see how this is all going to go down since we know how it ends up. So this is exciting. Great art.
Next up, Alien versus Captain America, number one from Marvel, written by Frank Thierry, art by Stefano Raphael. This is taking the action back to World War II, where Baron Strucker discovers some xenomorphs and is using them to create an army to let Red Skull conquer the world. Oopsie daisy. In the middle of that comes Captain America, the Howling Commandos. I will say, hold on. Like, I know what you're in for here when you get Frank Thierry writing this.
Right.
But I was surprised how, like, restrained he was in this issue. That's my main thing. Yeah. Like, I'm sure the carnage is coming. But in this issue, it was like, okay, we got to set up the xenomorphs. Yeah. We got to set up who Captain America is, the mythology. And there are some wild moments in this issue. But I thought we were, I don't know, in my head, picking this up, I thought it was going to be like, from the first page, but instead it takes its time as a story.
I agree. It's a refreshing change. Oh, go ahead.
I feel like Frank Thierry really took the alien tone and style to heart in the storytelling here. Like, it's bringing us a definitively comic bookian story, but like the slower pace, the like, you know, sort of one by one revealing different aspects of the alien xenomorph, you know, life cycle, I guess you could say, while also getting some great Red Skull dust transformation scene coming out of a dude's tooth at the beginning. That was dope. The Thierry touch.
Yeah, yeah.
Hashtag that Thierry creepy touch.
The creepy dust, the evil skull dust. Yeah, I think this is, first off, cool cover. But yeah, this is a great setup. We've seen so many different alien stories and so many different Captain America stories, but I was impressed, like you, Alex, with the care and the pace that we were taking kind of in the setup of this. So it was a nice surprise, unlike the creepy skull dust. But yeah, I love this, and the art's fantastic.
Void Rivals, number 24 from Skybound and Image Comics, written by Robert Kirkman, art by Connor Hughes. This is the last issue before the big Quintesson War that is going to be kicking off next issue. So lots of setup going on here. But most importantly, great stuff happening with my boy Skuckzoid in this issue.
Absolutely. Come on, the Skuck saving the day.
Oh, my God. Those pages, I live for those pages. The thing where... Sorry. So for people who don't know, Skuckzoid is this like pig rock man, and they discovered that if you cut him pieces off of him, he grows more of himself. So the prime Skuckzoid, the original Skuckzoid, is using the Skuckzoid we've been following to create more. And he breaks out this issue and is basically like, I'm going to lead this revolution of these pieces that have grown out of me. First, they have the joke of the pieces all being like, my wife, my kids, which very funny. And then following that up with him being like, and we're going to take back and start the revolution. And one of them in the corner is like, what are you talking about? Because he was just bored.
Yeah.
Again, very funny joke. So I could honestly care less about the rest of this book. Those two pages, delightful.
What? Oh, my God. Oh, my God. I'm glad you have two pages.
Are you really into what's going on with Hadroid?
Yes!
Let me say, it's crazy that the part of this comic that made the most sense is what you just described, Alex, where a pink rock man is cloned from pieces, says my wife, my kids, and then says he's going to fight a revolution, and someone was like, WTF? And you're like, that's awesome. Because the rest of this comic, I agree, I'm like, I don't know. Everyone wears different clothes all the time. Handroid's the only character I'm like, I see. I know him. I know when I start talking to the hand. But everyone else, I'm like, I don't know what you're saying, why you're saying it. And there's like a war coming. This comic has the most like negotiation calmly between the two different planets where like, we should get along. I'm like, you're in a fight now, next issue? Why are you fooling us so many times, comic?
I think this continues to be a really great comic. I love all the kind of drama and amazing art and panels we get in this issue. The like neon handcuffs that were kind of in that one panel were so cool. And plus we're talking about one of the best letters pages in the business. Talk to the Handroid. This continues to be a tight package, a ton of fun. I might not know what everything that is happening is going on, but I'm still very much enjoying it. And Skuxoid for life, bro.
Shouts to this issue or this series for being the one that Pete knows the most about, issue to issue.
Absolute Superman, number 13 from DC Comics, written by Jason Aaron, art by Rafa Sandoval. Keep it with the war, the battle for Kansas kicks off in this issue as Superman, Lois Lane, and Jimmy Olsen finally together are huddled in the remains of Smallville, which is under attack by the Lazarus Corporation, led by Ra's al Ghul and his daughter Talia. Big things going down in this issue. What did you guys think? Pete?
Yeah.
This comic, I feel like, is absolute genius, a subtle genius here going on. And it's this issue in particular does it, where, like, the Superman origin, the deconstruction of the Superman origin that this comic has done is just so smartly paced out. And this issue, we have Superman crash landing in Smallville. Sound familiar? He did it as a baby in the regular continuity. In this, he crash lands in Smallville and becomes Superman. He starts to have people rallying behind him. Lois Lane becomes a reporter in this issue. She's trying to get word out to the rest of the populace. Jimmy Olsen is like, I was a shit photographer until I landed here. They called me Three Thumbs Olsen. He becomes the photographer. Like, they're so subtly doing it that I feel like it's not on – it'd be so easy to just be like, look, they're who they are now. But Jason Aaron is slow playing us so hard here, and it's working just very effectively to do it at this pace.
I think that this has this kind of great epic feel to it. Love the art and the kind of pace and everything that is happening. There was just some weird lines that pulled me out a little bit. And also, like, the cape kind of power was a little boosted up, and I thought kind of insane. But I'm enjoying this very much.
You don't like a power
much.
Cape?
Well, like I just feel cape? Like it's like, hey, I have a cape that also can protect all of the world and everyone who lives here. So I was just kind of like, wow, that's a really powerful cape that you have that's never done that before. But okay, cool.
It's a computer cape. You got a computer cape to do more.
Then the line at the end where it was like, hey, you're going to be my son. It's like, that's not how kids work, but cool.
Well, but that's been the thing that he's talked about the entire time. Like, that is – all of both of those things have been set up in the plot. The cape has been there since the first issue. Ra's al Ghul has consistently said, I'm going to make you the son of the demon. That is what he has been doing. So all of that has been threaded throughout. That's not new. This
still of a weird thing to yell to somebody, you're going to be my son.
I yell that at you
that's
every
weird.
Time
I say
you.
That all the time. Yeah.
It still feels weird. Feels weird.
I and say then that the to line, my like, mailman.
Hey, write whatever you want, Lois. I was like, oh, what's that kind of tone? You know what I mean? He's like, yeah, just write whatever you want, Lois. I don't give a shit. I was like, damn.
I don't think that's what was meant there.
Well,
interesting. You're having an interesting experience with this title. I also think this is fantastic. The art is great. The battle scenes are epic. There are some interesting tweaks on the mythology, and it gets better every issue. Moving on to Amazing Spider-Man number 15 from Marvel, written by Joe Kelly, art by Emilio Lazo. We are skipping every issue with Earth Spider-Man and Space Spider-Man. Save your question for a moment, Peter. I'm going to recap the issue and maybe it'll answer it. So in this issue set in space, Spider-Man has been fighting to get stronger, to go back and fight a guy named Hellgate. And he got a alien costume that is not a symbiote, but actually a Technarch. As we discover in this issue, it is very much still alive, and he makes a decision to bring it back to life. Some great stuff going down in this issue. Some big actions, some funny bits between Rocket and Spider-Man. Really nice twist on the symbiote mythology that riffs on it while doing something new. And then also, at the same time, some really good romance stuff at the end. All right, moving on to our next title. I'm sorry, Pete, did you have a question?
I just had a quick question before you get into everything that happened in the comic that
Daddy not kissing Mary Jane? Was that your question?
No, and that's a horrible impression of me. I wanted
you
to
You should
see...
really listen to one of these podcasts.
Yeah, if you play back the podcast, that was very accurate.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Also, that was my Cobra Commander voice.
Oh, well, interesting.
Also, Pete, soup.
I want to ask Alex a question before we kind of got into what happens in the comic book. I saw this cover and I got excited for you, Alex, and I wondered if you got excited because you were like, oh, maybe that's Cypher. It kind of looks like a little bit of a Cypher symbiote kind of thing coming out of Spider-Man a little bit. I was wondering, before you read this, did you have any of that going on?
I freaked out. Like, I freaked out. You know, they put up these covers 3 months ago because that's how solicits work.
Right.
And whenever you don't see me, I am screaming at the top of my head.
Yeah.
Because the very idea of seeing Cypher is something that makes me meltdown. I've been vomiting, sneezing, shitting, pissing,
shitting.
It's a lot of ings.
Soaking.
It's a lot of ings.
All the holes, man. All the holes. Like,
all
just
the holes
constantly. Do you want me to
Alex
keep talking
in
about this?
I appreciate it. I was there when you were brought into your inpatient facility for treatment for the Cypher incident. It was a full open hole incident. If you want to read the report, Pete, I'll send it your way.
Yeah. Oh, thanks. So, no, guess not. But I do agree with you that this is a lot of fun. I think this is a very cool idea. I think Joe Kelly is doing some great stuff here. I mean, other than the kiss, I was having a great time. I think, this is a ton of action, very cool stuff. The romance stuff was great.
Do you like the kiss?
I did not like the kiss, but everything else I thought was cool.
Why you don't like him kissing someone and having a nice time?
Yeah, exactly. I think that...
think Spider-Man should be miserable?
Well, no, I have my ships, and I root for them.
Well, my ship, and my ship always has been Spider-Man and whoever that is.
Cypher.
Yeah. Yeah, I've always been in for Space Shay, who he's with now. The perfect team up. What is a relationship but just a great 3 or 4 issue team up, you know?
Oh, man. Wow.
What'd you think, Justin?
I love this. I love the jumping back and forth between Earth and space. I like that Peter Parker is feeling guilty about missing out on his friends and family on Earth, especially Shay, probably, since he may or may not be dating her. But he also is like, he's avoiding going back to have to confront Hellgate. We get to see that teased up a little bit here, but I think this Technarch Spidey is going to be the person that has to face down Hellgate, and I think that's cool.
Cypher
and I think
Spidey,
he should kiss anyone he wants. Yes.
Oh, that's nice.
Why don't we move on and talk about Archie versus Minor Threats, number 3 from Dark Horse Comics and Archie Comics, written by Patton Oswalt, Jordan Bloom, and Timmy Heeg, art by Scott Koblish. In the end of the last issue, as usually happens with these sort of crossovers, everybody switched. So the Archie gang is now dark supervillains over in Twilight City, and the Minor Threats gang is earnest, squeaky clean teens living in Riverdale. Things tend to get a little more mixed up by the end of the issue. But, man, I love this crossover. I know I shout it out every issue, but Scott Koblish effortlessly switching styles between the two looks of the two different worlds is very cool. And I love some of the mashups here. The characters they come up with.
Oh, my
this
God.
Is, you're going to hate this, Pete, because you're like, whoa, stop talking badly about history. I think the villains and hero characters they came up with for the Archie characters in this book are better than the Red Circle superheroes that they've come up with.
Oh, wow.
Like, I like them better. I thought these were great. And the punctuation with Jughead.
I laughed out loud with the Jughead Dr. Manhattan. It was just hysterical. The eye hunger, the whole thing.
Also, shout out to our Barfly guy turning into Bughead. That was a pretty funny joke as well. So,
Bughead's
very funny,
good.
Great Bughead. Action. Good emotion here. Great Danger. Another banger for this series.
Bughead all day.
Was that enough for you? Was that enough for seeing you? For you for seeing Bughead represented here as just the word?
It was. It was. Just saying it makes me excited and feel joy. Yeah, this
how
was
many
such
holes,
a great.
How many holes did you release from?
Yeah, I'm not going to talk about that.
You were so excited. Which holes?
I agree with Alex, though, that this was a great mashup and such a blast and just such a great use of characters and just amazing writing and amazing art. It's impressive.
Yeah, also really enjoying this. I'll comment on the art. The switching back and forth between sort of a more like gothic horror-y style and the straight up Archie Universe style of art is really cool, really difficult, I imagine, to put together. There's a panel where one of the characters, the monster character, is sort of in a darker, more horror look, watching Archie-looking characters through a diner window. That was like, oh, man, that's so really reflecting the story through the art in a way that is so excellent comic book-y stuff. So really, really great.
Batman number 3 from DC Comics, written by Matt Fraction, art by Jorge Jimenez. Bunch of stuff going on in this issue. First and foremost, Vandal Savage is tightening the noose around Batman and Robin, trying to frame them for murder. And at the same time, Riddler has popped up and is back to his old tricks, kind of. But it leads to another Gotham scientist trying to do something with Gotham villains and it going terribly wrong. I'm curious to hear from you guys because I feel like you've been a little iffy on this new series so far. I think I've been the most positive, but maybe I'm remembering that wrong. How did you feel about this issue?
I think Pete's been down on it. I've been pretty up on it. But it's interesting. There's something happening here it must be intentional. We have like Batman saying things like, that's another comic. I think the art is really working here. I really like the portrayal of the Riddler here as like sort of at the mercy of riddles. He can't help himself. I thought was really well done. I love the stealth suit here. There's a lot of cool stuff going on. We're seeing a lot of the other characters here. And what I was going to say that now I'm figuring out is that there's like references here to being like, oh, the same old thing happening again. And I think that that's intentional for a writer to put that in there. And I don't know why, because that's sort of referencing the fact that we're seeing ideas we've seen before, like the Batman being framed, cops out to kill Batman and Robin. So I don't know. What do you guys think about that? It feels odd.
Well, this is looking ahead, and this is not a spoiler because I don't actually know how it happens because they haven't said anything about it, but there's a big new villain that's supposed to be coming next issue, I think, called the Minotaur. And what the Minotaur certainly implies is a maze. So perhaps there is something to what you're saying, Justin, that there's something about, like, there is a bigger game being played here with Batman to make him hit his greatest hits in a certain way or remix his greatest hits because he is trapped perhaps in a maze of his past adventures or something. Like
that could be the Minotaur famous. Sorry, last thing. Sorry, Batman the Animated Series Minotaur Riddler episode from back in the day.
Interesting.
Nice shout out. I also really enjoyed this. I think that the I have mixed feelings about the new suit. I mean, lights on a bat suit just seems like that's a kind of problematic, you know, for stealth. But I do think that, like, the love the Alfred stuff. Very touching, very fun. The old kicked in the nuts bit was really a fun thing there. And so, yeah, I'm having a blast with this. I love the pace and the action of it. I do think it's interesting because we have read so many Batman stories and we have seen things done so many different ways. So it is kind of a little meta and weird when they're kind of commenting on stuff that we have seen before. But it didn't hit me as weird as it hit you, it seemed, Justin. But yeah, I think this is in great hands and really doing some great stuff.
And now the revelation has begun once again. The age of revelation is upon us. I don't think we made a decision whether we were talking about all of these or not.
Revelations.
So we're going to keep talking about all of them, I guess.
I think so, we should. Right.
Yeah, I think like we should. Specifically, and I know I said we weren't going to overall talk about stuff, and I'll just mention we're going to talk about Amazing X-Men number 2, Binary number 2, Laura Kinney Sabretooth number 2, and Longshots number 2. The thing that we've
been...
A lot of number 2s. All number 2s all month long.
Makes sense.
The thing that we've been talking about all along that, like, or I've been harping on about this event not having a spine, I think you start to see a little more of the direction, at least in some of the books here. It's still not quite there, and maybe I'm not totally into it, but, like, particularly Amazing X-Men, obviously, Jed MacKay is sort of like the showrunner of this event, so you're getting more of the hints of things that are to come in that book. But I also felt like in the other ones as well, they're starting to touch on, like, okay, here's the overall arc of where we're going, and I like that a little bit better. Still mixed about some of the titles, but that's my take.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. There's a reveal that happens here that I will spoil, that Cyclops is out here with these X-Men, and they're sort of like trying to figure out what to do. They think they have a plan. And there's a thing where it's like, hey, we don't care that you're here. We sent our Scott back in time to stop this. I was like, oh, that's a great central idea. So that makes Scott, this past Scott who's stuck in the future, the underdog. And it gives him a real drive to, like, try to save this world by rallying the X-Men, which he tries to do at the end of this issue with Psylocke. And I'm dumbfounded why that wasn't the end of the first issue in Age of Revelation Alpha. That should have been the point of this. And then we could be like, yes, this is a Cyclops story. He's going to rebuild the shattered X-Men, and they are going to fight Revelation. And instead, we've sort of like wandered around a bit for this first, you know, few months of this, when I think we could have just done this. And it's exciting. It's good.
By the way, if you're only listening to the podcast and not watching, I believe Pete is passing a kidney stone right now. Is that what's going on?
Yeah.
Who says yes, a Cyclops story? Are you out of your fucking mind?
I like Cyclops.
I also like Cyclops.
Oh, puke. Anyways, yeah, this puke. Issue...
that's a hole. That's Pete coming out of hole.
That's
this,
one.
These twos, this run here this week is not as impressive as I would have liked it to been, but there is some highs and lows. For me, this issue, Amazing X-Men number 2 here, works really hard to be like, hey, Scott's actually, guys, if you think about it, he's kind of maybe a good leader, right? And it's like, no, don't fucking try that shit with me. I've been reading X-Men comics for way too long for you to try to sneak in an issue that shows that Cyclops is a good leader. You can go fuck yourself with that premise. I did love Evil Juggernaut. I thought that this is a fun Juggernaut take. Grey Beast still sucks ass. But other than that, interesting art. Cool kind of use of the kind of devil Ileana for this issue.
Yeah,
well,
not
I
all
love
of the dialogue
fight that they have.
I like the fight that they had, which was based on telling each other a truth. there was a little bit of like a logical problem there in terms of this Cyclops doesn't know this Ileana, and it's 10 years later. And I was like, I don't know if they actually know anything about each other to hurt each other with truths, but yeah. As is, I thought it was an interesting idea. Like I said before, I liked knowing that plot point of, oh, here's what's actually really going on with this event. 2 months in, cool. Like you were saying, Justin, now we can get going. And yeah, there you go. Why don't we move on and talk about Binary, number 2, written by Stephanie Phillips, art by Giada Belviso. This issue, we do indeed get to see Carol Danvers, find out how she became imbued with the Phoenix Force, kind of what happened to Jean Grey. Specifically, she was protecting the Earth from the rest of the cosmos from the X virus getting out. And we get a reveal of our redhead at the end. And I gotta say, we pointed out the end of the last issue was confusing because they revealed a redhead and we were like, which redhead? There are several redheads in the Marvel Universe and it could be many yeah. of them. You need to say who it is. I'm sorry. At this issue, they reveal it and it's clearly Madeline Pryor, but
definitely Carol's Madeline like, Pryor.
Jean? Yeah. I was like, no, just say Madeline. What? Why are we being so secretive and confusing about this thing?
That was so confusing. It was a weird thing because it was like, hey, I'm going to talk to Jean, who is this Phoenix bird, and I'm going to have a conversation with Jean, and then I get the reveal that it looks like Jean, but it's not Jean, but then I'm going to confuse the reader by going, Jean? I'm going, you can't talk to the bird Jean the whole time and then do a Jean reveal at the end. That just makes no fucking sense. We were just talking to Jean. You can't be like, Jean?
Guys, you got to read a little further here because it was clearly a cut-off line of dialogue. The line was, Jean, or the clone of Jean, who married Scott and birthed Nathan Summers and the character that later becomes Strife, and then was later killed, and that Jean was found underneath the ocean and was later given the Phoenix Force after Madeline, who had became the Dark Phoenix and then was killed because she was evil, allowing Jean to come back and still be the same hero that she was in the past and to be married to Scott again, even though there was a weird relationship because of the whole fathering parenting his son that wasn't theirs, it was sent into the future to then come back in time and become Cable, even though he's much older than his dad and his mom, but is now the character known as Jean.
Wait, so you're saying that was all there, but because I'm not classically trained as an actor, I missed it?
It's not even acting, it's just, reading.
You're reading! It seemed like it was all the acting.
Did you?
You're out here sucking soup, but I'm here reading.
Last year, they had an ad for X-ray glasses. Did you get the X-ray glasses, Pete, so you could properly read this issue? Or did you order the sea monkeys like we explicitly told you not to?
I'm a sucker for sea monkeys. Yeah.
I know.
Pete just wants to kick sand, suck it on those sea monkeys. Pete wants to kick sand into his bully's face at the beach.
Here's the thing, to be like a little positive about this book, I like the idea of Carol Danvers trying to hold the last human city and the humans in a very like COVID vaccine denial metaphor way, yes. being like, we're fine. What are you talking about? This is fine. That's a really interesting idea at the center there. I think it gets mucked up a little bit with all the Phoenix stuff with Jean Grey, and that's what's not working for all of us is, I think, what we're getting here. But that center there, that very human idea, I do think is interesting. I wish they'd explore it more, but at this point, we only have one more issue, so I guess we'll see. Next up, we got Laura Kinney, Sabretooth, number 2, written by Erica Schultz, art by Valentina Pinti. Laura Kinney, who is now called Sabretooth, is on the side of Revelation, but is feeling very conflicted because Gabby and, what is he called now, Aki? Are trying to get her Alex. Son off world through a gate created by Sage. Their eventual goal is Mars. And this also gets towards the bigger piece. We've been slowly seeding throughout these series that Apocalypse is not that pleased with what Revelation is doing. So I think I liked that aspect of the issue, seeing that, like, okay, we are building up to this conflict, presumably, between Apocalypse and Revelation that's going to go down.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, because I agree with you. This is like a big step in that direction. But we had the origin of that idea was in the Age of Revelation anthology, where one of the stories mm-hmm. had Professor X going to Araco being like, hey, man, your boy's fucking up the earth. And he's like, huh? As if Apocalypse is just not reading the news, I guess. But, like, how's this story going to play out? Like, Apocalypse with Professor X is going to come down and fight Revelation, and we're going to root for... We're going to be on the side of...
we're going to root for...
Because it seems like... They want the outcome to be...
I don't know. I think this ends up in a place where, like, the entire Earth is destroyed, right? Like, everything is destroyed, everything's in ruins. And Scott's like, ooh, yeah, we really need to stop that from happening. And that's where they go back and they...
And he just murks win? Doug.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's like, hey, Doug, don't do that. I don't know.
I do think it's an interesting idea of the reveal at the end here where it's like... you know, because this is an interesting comic. I love the art. There was tons of action. And it's kind of like, okay, Sabretooth here seems like on the wrong side. And we got this kind of reveal. It's like, hey, don't worry. If you hate Revelations, we all kind of hate them. Apocalypse is going to be the real bad. And it's like, oh, phew, relief. But then it's like, well, why did we build up Revelations if it really was?
Well, no, be at the end of... not this issue, of Amazing X-Men, they reveal that Revelation is going to destroy the Earth. So he's the bad guy. Apocalypse and Professor X are going to try to stop him, so we're on their side. But just to talk about this book, I do think there's some conflicted dynamics going on that Erica Schultz writes very well with Laura Kinney. She clearly has a really good handle on the character, and that comes through, particularly with like a really devastating scene with Sage towards the end there, or Paige with Sage. Sage Paige, if you will. So Paige, I did Sage. Like that. But let's turn and talk about my favorite book on the stands right now, Long Shots number 2, written by Jonathan Hickman and Jerry Duggan, art by Alan Robinson. I think, Justin, you pointed this out with the first issue, that you were like, why are you doing a parody of this event in the middle of this event? I agree with you.
Roasting it.
At the same time, as insane as it is that this is happening and probably should not be happening, it's still great. Everything in this book is great, as you have this team of absolutely doomed pseudo-heroes, including Bishop. There's a great bit in the middle where somebody's like, hey, you don't have the Winter Soldier's arm, you have Cable's arm. And he's like, oh, man, and peels off the star. They have a whole bit going on with Cable's arm and time travel. Multiple people are dying. Wonder Man is being super weird about his relationship with Hellcat. The character dynamics are so funny. All the stuff going on with Mojo and Longshot trying to get a better contract and the X-Babies. Great. Every page of this is great. A treasure it is. And month.
Let me highlight an exchange between... baby Colossus and baby Wolverine. That's not their names. But they're like, don't forget to vote on which of the cast will get tomorrow's first kill. It rhymes with Flavin. And which member is most likely to get a teammate killed? That rhymes with Blavin. And which member is most likely to get me too'd?
I didn't like that joke. That pulled me right out of that.
Well, but then read the dialogue that follows that up.
Which isn't cool, but also rhymes with Craven.
Yeah, I didn't like that meme.
Was that the win that you wanted, Alex?
Nope.
Yeah.
But at least there is that extra piece of dialogue. They're recognizing it's
not. Yes, no.
Making a joke that isn't great and being like, hey, that's not great is not.
Nailed it, someone gets.
It pulled me right out of it. I was having a great time, and then they made a Me Too joke, and I was like, yikes, bro.
Saying someone's getting Me Too'd, it's just a very old thing to say. Like, it's an old person thing to say, I feel like. So, like, it was just a strange thing that was coming out of one of the X-Babies in the morning show parody that they were doing at the top of this. But I agree with you, Alex. This book is so strange. It's very surprising. In an event where there's a lot of hit or miss... This is a hit in a, like, weird area. it's like hitting the foul pole in the World Series and being like, pretty good.
Yeah, I was having a blast.
Baseball guys?
Yeah, yeah. I was Not having Yeah, game seven was crazy. I was having a blast, but then that one joke kind of pulled me out. But yeah, this is crazy fun and kind of insane to be pulling off in the middle of all this.
Next up, we are moving on from the Age of Revelation to talk about Space Scouts, number one from Dark Horse Comics, written by Matt Kent, art by David Rubin. This is an entirely new series that is about a contest between 1,000 contestants to see who gets to be a member of Space Scouts, basically like an Avengers in space or Guardians of the Galaxy, but like real primo type thing. And we're following one character who isn't even sure she wants to do it, but gets sucked into the competition anyway. There's some twists, there's some turns throughout. As usual, Matt Kent just has an expert handle on structure, on character, everything that's going on. Pete, you were pumping and cheering, so why don't you start on this one?
Yeah, this is such a blast. The art does such a great job of creating such an interesting world and sucks you right into this magic and this kind of like unique character that we're following along here. Really kind of reminded me of the, the Mockingbird series, or what was the, what's her name?
Hunger Games.
Thank you so much. Yeah. But yeah, I'm hooked after this first issue. I just think they did such a great job of setting all of this up, which is hard to kind of do and still make it interesting. So yeah, really impressive art. Really impressive storytelling. I'm so excited to kind of get into the rest of what's going to happen here. Absolute blast of a first issue.
Yeah, this is a premise we've seen a couple times before in the last few years, but really well done. Matt Kent has just a great flair for making his stories unique in whatever genre they are in. This is really, really fun. There's definitely some suspicious areas that are seeded but not really exploited here. And a lot happens in this issue. This really goes much further than I thought it would in issue number one.
Yeah.
Next up, Absolute Green Lantern, number 8 from DC Comics, written by Al Ewing, art by Jenoy Lindsay. This is a kickoff of a new arc, and specifically, we are taking a look at the past and history of Sojourner Mullen.
Yes, Joe.
Of Green Lantern here, sort of Green Lantern at her past. I thought this was the best issue of this book so far.
Oh, yeah. This is my favorite issue of the week.
Really? Justin, let's take away. Of the week. Talk about it.
I thought this was great. Like, Al Ewing just really, in a series that has been sort of a little bit, like, coy with information, sort of purposefully, like, sort of being a little bit weird as it's building out the mythology, we just get a banger breakdown of Joe's life in the Absolute Universe. And it's super interesting. It's the ring takes on so much more meaning and power in this comic, which is great, as we see on this cover, which is, you know,
sick cover, bro. It's a cool cover.
It's ill. It's positively ill. This cover needs to be treated with several very dense bananas. You be illin'. But I just thought this was fantastic. It makes for, I like the use of different characters from the normal, the regular DC universe that we get to see in the Absolute versions of. Renee Montoya, very cool. It was very cool.
Yeah. I agree with all that. This is just such an impressive, artistically created comic. Just solid story. I really continue to enjoy this. More Joe as Green Lantern, please. Just having a blast. Love the kind of cameos and stuff that we got here. Guy Gardner was hilarious in the background.
Yeah. Next up, The Avengers, number 32 from Marvel, written by Jed McKay, art by Fareed Karami. Kang has been revealed as the big villain here. They are on Battleworld from Secret Wars and fighting back against him and his army of zombies. And it's not going great for the Avengers. They're giving it all they got. But don't worry, there's a big city with a bigger heart on its way to save them. Justin, Jed McKay is your boy.
Yeah, JT says, what feeling? You got to say there, Stash Man?
I mean, the fact that we are able to make reference to the Ashen Combine you know, and how they really set up and introduced us to the city. The Black Order, you know, another great adjective and noun. And then now, of course, we have the introduction of the Twilight Court, another group of people who are vaguely similar to the Avengers, but slightly different in certainly unique and unbelievable ways. It's not that I don't like what's happening. I sort of like the story. It's just crazy to me that so much of Jed McKay's work in the Avengers world has been to create different adjective noun combinations of superhero teams. It's like he's getting paid by the character at this point. Ooh.
Well, it'd be interesting if he was, but I think this is this is huge. There's a lot going down in this issue that they're kind of the hard thing for me was the kind of last panel reveal where I was like, oh shit, oh I don't know who this is. I got to look this up. So I had to check my nerd card, you know. So that was a tough moment. But a lot going down. Tons of action. Love the pace and the art.
Death Dog, number one from Ahoy Comics, written by Bryce Ingman, art by Alan Robinson. This is following it takes place in a future where dogs have died out. They created a bunch of robot dogs, and eventually the robot dogs have been repurposed into very extreme police dogs, except for one who...
Potato.
There's a little mystery there, but yes, there is a very sweet robot dog, the last one around, who has been recommissioned, and maybe the scientists place something so that his consciousness can come back in this new Death Dog form. He befriends a kid felon who maybe also has a heart of gold. I thought this was great. Just a perfect Ahoy Comics book. It's satirical, it's funny, but there's also a real heart to it. Like, the scene at the beginning with the scientists I thought was so sweet and nice. And then everything throughout with the dog saying potato, with the kid who he befriends, just great stuff.
Yeah, I agree. This is a blast. Use of potato is fun and adorable. Yeah, I like the art style, the kind of cartoonish softness of the art kind of softens a little bit of the madness for this world, which works well. And at the end of the day, you got an adorable kid and dog story. So, I mean, come on, let's tugging at your heartstrings, even though this dog will rip people's hands off like you can't fucking believe.
A lot of hands popping off in this comic.
Hand ripping.
Curious to see where the story... Where the story goes from here, the idea of like far too aggressive policing, sort of thoughtless punishment, I feel like are really interesting. I'm curious how that's going to advance in the next issue, because they certainly put it on the table in this issue.
Next up, JSA number 13 from DC Comics, written by Jeff Lemire, art by Gavin Guidry. We're jumping back in time for a year one arc showing us the origins of the Justice Society. Now, we talked to Gavin Guidry about a little less than a year ago at this point, where he was talking about doing a couple of fill-ins here and there on JSA with some year one stuff. But it seems like they're blowing that out into a whole arc, and I couldn't be happier, not only because this is like a sweet spot for the JSA, having them as mystery men investigating a murder. That's just great. That's exactly where you want to see them. But man, Gavin Guidry's art on this is so good. Like, it's not a one-to-one by any means, but I definitely got like very pleasant, less cartoony Darwin Cook vibes off of the way that he lays out these pages. This is everything that I want from a JSA title. I am hyped out all my holes.
Wow. Look at you.
There it is.
Hole hyping.
Alex.
Oh, man. All his holes are
hyped. Catchphrase machine tonight from sucking soup to
my
hole hyping.
My holes are open and ready to receive more JSA. Wow. Does that work?
This man is deeply ill. I also really like this. The art does have like a nice sort of contrast between like a lot of bright pages and sort of a menacing darkness for some of the other ones. I love characters like Our Man. You just don't get to see them, and to have them be in their disparate pocket where they're not super involved in a larger convoluted plot like a lot of JSA stories where there's so many characters that need to be folded in. I like the focus we get here. So I'm definitely fully in on this year one arc.
Yeah, fold in the cheese. Yeah, I think that this is just old-timey fun here. This is great, fantastic setup, amazing art, you know, classic kind of Nazi hijinks. So, yeah, this is an absolute blast.
Yeah. Next up, Echo, Seeker of Truth, number one from Marvel, written by Taboo and B. Earl and Melissa Flores, art by Jim Terry and Kyle Charles. This is a Marvel Voices issue. It's telling two different tales of Echo, one that redefines her powers in a surprising way. I had been sort of glibly saying, like, oh, they're just going to bring her in line with the way that she was in the TV show. Not at all. They go in a totally different direction with
her
powers.
How dare you?
In the first story, and then the backup story is an otherwise unrelated one that is teeing up a arc in, I want to say it's the Marvel Voices digital comic that comes out through Marvel Unlimited. What do you guys think about this?
This was cool. Yeah, it was a great kind of visual representation of her powers, you know, with the letters kind of bouncing off people's faces and stuff. So unique, cool. Yeah, I love the kind of action and the, you know, taking down Mr. Purple. So the Purple Man or, you know, whatever you want to call him there, Purple Sorcerer X, he's a douche and deserves what he got. So great. Yeah, I thought this was solid.
I really love the character of Echo in the comics, especially. I thought this issue did a great job of sort of referencing all of the stories that are sometimes disparate stories that have come from the original Daredevil arc, which was so beautifully done, to like the Ronin stuff, and then some later stuff where there's one point where she's like, I was briefly, I forget what it was, like,
not she was Venom, like, I briefly like, had a TV show, and that was pretty cool.
Yeah, I don't think she referenced
Phoenix.
The,
she was briefly the Phoenix.
Phoenix, that's it. Yeah. It's Phoenix. I was like, what a funny thing to throw in here. I also got to shout out part of the Purple Man's commitment to wearing a purple suit everywhere he goes. Mm-hmm. He's in like hippie cult commune, and he steps out and he's wearing like a square ass tie and white shirt. Was funny to me, and this was a nice issue.
Assorted Crisis Events, number 6 from Image Comics, written by Dennis Camp, art by Eric Zawadzki. If you don't know yet, this title deals with different forms of temporal displacement. And here we're getting a sci-fi, very lightly sci-fi riff on dementia as a wife tries to hold it together as her husband jumps forward and backwards and sometimes sideways in time. He is unstuck, but sometimes he's a little kid. Sometimes he's an adult. Sometimes, very briefly, he's her husband. And it's just something that she's dealing with less and less as it goes. Another, I thought, fantastic issue of this book that really got me choked up by the end there.
Oh, holy shit. Beautiful. This was upsetting. A very upsetting issue. But great. The way that this comic, each issue, is able to get me in the same place emotionally from a very different characters and very different, but, you know, sci-fi, from a sci-fi point of view, very related stories. It is amazing. It's like if Ice Cream Man was very focused on a particular aspect of a horror trope or something. Like, it's really hard to do, and it keeps doing it every time. Highly recommend this comic.
Yeah, this is artistically so beautiful, very moving. The representation of life and the struggles and ups and downs are, it's really impressive. The one where it was just like this kind of like maze and, just the panels on here, the coloring, the tone of it, just, gets you in the feels. It's really impressive comics right here.
Birds of Prey, number 27 from DC Comics, written by Kelly Thompson, art by Sammy Basri. This title is almost over at this point. We're heading towards the
one more
game.
Issue.
One more issue. As the birds are fighting against the
enemies
who
cried
them pretty much since the beginning. All of his holes are open. Finally.
Oh, yeah. Boy.
Great art, as usual. Fun story. I am going to miss Barda and Small Bat teaming up, personally.
Yes. I'm also going to miss the crap out of this. Barda, the Gargoyle Queen, is just such a fun characterization of her, and I'm having a blast with this. I don't want this to ever to end, so this is breaking my heart. Amazing art. That's too bad. Amazing writing. This team is phenomenal. I don't ever want them to stop going on adventures together because they work so well together. It's I love this comic.
Yeah, I mean, we've said this is one of the most consistent comics on the stands, and the fact that they're able to really pass the baton back and forth between the characters from the writing and art point of view is very amazing. Barda is the star of this comic in a fun way that I think that's the thing I'm going to miss the most.
All right, next up is Minor Arcana, number 11 for Boob Studios by Jeff Lemire. In this issue, our main character is getting further sucked into a conspiracy that spirals around her.
Not soup sucking.
Not soup sucking, but conspiracy sucking. Specifically, it is gathering around her, and she is somewhat unaware of what's going on while she continues to explore her powers and finds out something surprising about her mom. I'm really liking this. I don't have too much more to say other than Jeff Lemire is also very consistent. But what'd you guys think?
Yeah, I agree. This continues to be fantastic, unbelievable art. A lot goes down in this issue as far as like powers and things that are concerned. And I'm excited to see what's going to happen next. I think this is creative and cool in all the right ways.
Yeah, I like this as well. It's a nicely unfolding plot that's been happening over the series here. Like it's been, it's taken its time, and it's been. I'm surprised that it's still we're on issue 11, and it feels like it moved really quickly for the first few issues, and now it's really settled in. On the live show, Frank Barbieri talked about like doing sort of slow comics, like slowing down the storytelling. It feels like this comic sort of realized it could just sort of ease into the water a little bit, and we're getting it here, while at the same time getting some of the bigger revelations here with the mom.
Did Frank talk about this comic at all on the show, or...?
He did not talk about this comic. But
we really should have talked to him. We should have talked to him.
We should have.
Cheetah and Cheshire, Rob the Justice League, number 4 from DC Comics, written by Reg Grucka, art by Nicholas Scott. In this issue, the team is finally ready to rob the Justice League, head up to the Watchtower and take it to them. But one problem is they find out Wonder Woman is there, and nobody believes that Cheetah is going to be able to hold it together when she does. I'm really enjoying this. I like the slow burn build of the heist throughout this series. And in particular, I love Nicola Scott's Wonder Woman. She draws an amazing Wonder Woman, I think.
Yeah.
So it was nice to see that again in this issue. Pete, I know you've been a little iffier about this because of the pace. Feeling it any better this issue?
Yes. Thank you. Yes, I am. I feel like some things really kind of clicked in this issue. We're really getting close to the actual heist, which is exciting. They're doing such a good job of building towards this. Yeah, it's actually happening. I agree. The art is fantastic. The facial stuff is fantastic. It's great to be able to kind of read people in the art. So, yeah, just super impressed with this issue. I thought it did a great job of kind of clicking things in. So I can't wait to see what goes down next.
Agree. I've been enjoying this. The thing that stood out to me most in this issue was this comic has no business referencing so many other DC characters and the continuity going on with all of them. Like, we get a Flex Mentallo shout out here. We get so many like Watchtower folks just hanging out. And the story could just be like, yeah, there's Red Tornado over there, and then move on. But instead, they really go to give us a 360 look at this heist, which is just like maybe Greg Rucka studying the way that like Ocean's 11, like you really see the whole playing field before you get into the heist. And I think that's what we did, and that's what we're getting into at the end of this issue and into next.
Gotham Academy, first year, number two from DC Comics, written by Brendan Fletcher, art by Marco Ferrari. In this issue, we're finding out more about the student life at Gotham Academy. We've got a little bit of romance, headed home to meet the parents. Ooh, and meanwhile, romance. Scarecrow is making some moves over in the old Arkham Asylum, which is a real bummer for our main character's mom. I think we were all pretty positive about the first issue of this. How do you think it held up in issue number two?
I think it did hold up pretty well. I really love this art style. I think this is an interesting story. I'm really getting kind of sucked in here in such a great way. Not sucking soup, but sucked into the story.
Your soup sucking.
Fun interaction with Scarecrow. I like the main character. This is very cool. I'm into this now. More, please.
Yeah, continues on in a nice way. This feels like it's going to be a great trade as well.
Last but not least, Poison Ivy, number 38 from DC Comics, written by G. Willow Wilson, art by Marcio Takara. Big things going down in this issue as Ivy has found out that Janet from HR is working against her. So they go to confront the being who is responsible for it, leading to some big changes for the cosmology of the DC universe. I don't know what you call it, but like the green and the gray and the whole war there. There's a lot of mythology. The thing, this is not a huge revelation, but the thing that really struck me with this issue in particular is this feels like the successor to Swamp Thing, like very specifically. Yeah. Like, obviously we're dealing with some of those characters, but I think in terms of the careful pace that G. Willow Wilson has put out there, the look at the overarching mythology of the DCU and the way this works, while still keeping it very intimate and focused on these two characters, Ivy and Janet.
Janet from HR.
Great way.
I agree with you. Like the wide scope and then the narrow focus on the character relationship is so well done here. I love all the big mythology moves, but even more so the Janet Ivy relationship is so unique. Like it's built as a romance, but we know that, and there is some chemistry between them, but we also know that Poison Ivy is with Harley. So like, it's a constantly complicated romantic situation, and it makes you lean in so hard, even in this issue as Janet's dying. Ivy may kill her, but also is trying to save her and loves her. Janet loves Ivy. Like, it's a perfect just mess.
You love a triangle. You love a love triangle, dude. That's your favorite.
It's even beyond triangle. Jam. Yeah.
There's it betrayal. Is. It is beyond triangle. Yeah, I agree. This is a blast. I'm so glad what went down. And since we're not spoiling it, I won't be the one to spoil it. But what goes down with Janet from HR, I was excited about. I was nervous the whole
time. She doesn't look well, Pete. She doesn't look well.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but, you know, I still thought, whatever. I'm trying not to spoil it here.
Do you connect with her? How do you connect with her as in HR?
Yeah, this is far from HR, dude. You know what I mean? This is like...
Well, how often... I mean, you work in HR, so like, how often do you talk to Bog Venus?
A lot. You a talk lot? To... HR, you're constantly talking to people. You got to get the information.
Bog,
you know, especially if you're
gonna... I can't do it.
Let's try again next
Pete,
quarter.
I have Bog on line two for you. Oh, Bog's really trying to get all the appeal.
I got to loop back on that with Bog.
But yeah, I think this was a solid kind of wrap up here. And they've done such an amazing journey with this comic and this run. So I've been loving it. The art is phenomenal. It's creepy. It's beautiful. It's all the things.
And that is it for the stack. If you'd like to support this podcast and all the podcasts we do, as well as get ad-free versions of them, patreon.com/comicbookclub. Also, we do a live show every Tuesday night at 7 p.m. to YouTube. Come hang out.
Sure do.
We'd love to chat with you about comic books. Apple, Spotify, Android, or the app of your choice to subscribe, listen, and follow the show. Comicbookclublive.com for this podcast and many more. Until next time, we'll see you at the Comic Book Club.
Open up your soup hole. It's time to suck. We got stuff coming down the pipeline.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.